So what I'm going to present to you is a brief overview of what the National Research Council is. I won't go through all the slides and mention all of our project activities, but they'll all be downloadable on the slide deck from the website. So the National Research Council, not to be confused with NSERC, the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council, is probably Canada's biggest dedicated research activity center. We're about 4,000 employees with usually around 1,000 guest workers every year that perform directed research in various areas of human activity. The way we're doing it is, first of all, we're across the country. We have approximately 20 institutes. Two of those institutes are directly performing direct research relating to IT. There's IIT, my institute, the Institute for Information Technology, and there's also IMS. The difference between the two institutes is that IMS basically performs research at the hardware level, where IIT usually focuses on software-related research. We have a couple of other, I call them institutes, but one of them is more a program than an institute, that help to serve both our needs and the needs of all Canadians relating to both financing and information gathering or competitive technical intelligence. Those are IRAP. William Langley, a local IRAP ITA, will be discussing the role of IRAP and how it can help foster technology development in both SMEs and other organizations. And there's also CISTI, the Canadian Institute for Scientific and Technical Information, which is, I believe, the second biggest library in North America for scientific and technical information. Now, all of these institutes operate somewhat separately from each other because they're all in various areas of research. And with all of those institutes, they're all subdivided in various research groups. Now, if you look at our broader mandate, what's the mandate of the NRC? First of all, we're under the auspices of Industry Canada from the Government of Canada. And our role is basically to develop generic technologies. Generic technologies to help transform ideas into new products and services. Obviously, we can't do that alone. We can't do both the basic research, the applied research, and then the development. So a lot of our activities are based towards collaboration with either private industry, non-government organization, universities, and whatnot. I mentioned earlier that IIT, the Institute for Information Technology, is the most distributed institute within NRC. We're located in six cities. Fredericton is home to IIT eBusiness, but the Moncton Lab and the St. John Lab are both part of that IIT eBusiness. So in St. John, we focus on eHealth, in Moncton, eLearning, and in Fredericton, we have various fields of activity like human web, internet logic, privacy, security, and trust, and eGovernment, eCitizen. In Ottawa, we also have various groups of activities that involve computational video, high-performance computing, information security, which is closely related to privacy, security, and trust, integrated reasoning, interactive information, so analysis and retrieval and knowledge extraction. Also, our newest lab is the Interactive Language Technologies, and it's based in Gatineau. Software engineering and visual information technology. Now, within those groups, we also have programs that cut across various groups. Some of them include broadband visual communications and human-computer interaction. So if I talk about the group here in Moncton, and basically in Fredericton, we're about, in New Brunswick overall, we're about 80 people. Before IIT eBusiness was put into place about 2 years ago, IIT was one of the smallest institutes at the NRC. And it's now moving up the ladder, thankfully, because IT is a big area of research for the Canadian economy. We're now about 180 people across all sites. So in New Brunswick, we're about 80 people to 90 people. In Moncton, about 15, St. John, 15, and the rest in Fredericton. For those who have seen the construction on, I'm not very good with orientation, I believe it's that way. There's a new construction going on. We're going to be moving into that new wing over there, and we'll have 5,500 square feet. We'll be able to breathe finally, as opposed to the 3,300 square feet we have now. So what's the composition of this group, and what do we do? Basically, we have a very diversified group of people. We're in e-learning, and e-learning cuts basically across all disciplines. So we have a philosopher, educational psychologist, engineers, dedicated computer programmers, We have a former minister who's our business development officer, Georges Corriveau, who was the minister of the information highway that got started here in New Brunswick. And we have other NRC staff in Moncton. So there's a couple of IRAP personnel here in Moncton. There's also somebody from health, and Steve Marsh, who's the research lead for privacy, security, and trust is based in Moncton. Harold, you haven't cut me off yet. So I'm doing good?
You're way over.
Okay. Let me just talk about what our, you can read the rest on the website, our main research areas. What do we do in e-learning? We develop technologies to reduce development time for creating learning resources, and we work on technologies and resources to enhance learning outcomes. So you can check the slide deck. What you'll see there is several of our specific R&D activity areas, some of the technologies we're working on, a couple of projects that we have underway with various partners. And in the end, what you'll see is a lot of small type, but that's just meant as a placeholder for us. A bit of detail about what we do. William, I don't know if we made if we decided how the questions were going to be asked, or they asked by after each presenter, or before we get going.
If we have time after presenter one, I think it's important to get permission. Maybe we can limit it so to just one if it's necessary.
So before I present the next speaker, anybody have a question? One, according to William. Good. William's the next guy up. William will be speaking a bit about, first of all, he'll give us a short overview of what IRAP is, and then he'll speak to or discuss how to finance R&D projects, new technology, and tech transfer for the SME organization.
So my presentation is a little bit of a good news, bad news story. The bad news is that it's got to be very, very short. But the good news is that IRAP is an organization that works hard to try to make things happen and to bring to bear resources and capabilities and financing to people that want to sort of realize really nice technology and realize their dreams and moving forward their businesses. So what I'll do here very briefly is I'll talk very, very quickly, introduce IRAP first as an organization, and then I'll talk very, very quickly about the IRAP mandate, summarize the programs. I'll talk really principally about one program that is most applicable here. There will be a handout, or there'll be information on the website. There'll be presentations will be more or less compiled on the website, so you can get the additional information on all of the programs. The complementary information will be able to be downloaded. But I'll talk principally about one program. Then I'll talk specifically about how IRAP might apply itself in the circumstances of OSS, because it's a special situation, if you will, and an emerging situation in the IT industry. So first of all, IRAP, Rod said before, it's the Industrial Research Assistance Program. It's part of NRC. It's separate from the institutes. Its focus is towards industrial research that is within the industrial players, within small companies specifically, small and medium-sized enterprises. Basically, good news, bad story. Good news, bad news story. The really good news is that we fund projects. We have money to give away. So this is certainly a reason to pay attention. So we are focused on small companies. We also bring to bear expertise. We bring to bear knowledge and information that can be mentoring the organization to assist them in realizing what they are attempting to do. So it's not only money that we bring, it's also this added value or this expertise that is brought along in the whole mix. So our mandate within IRAP is to stimulate R&D in the private sector. So that is small companies. And typically a small company is 500 employees or less, and we mostly deal with organizations that are in the range of 5 to 100 employees. So we're very much focused on those small companies. And the idea here is that part of the mandate is to leverage the R&D activity into a real opportunity. We're not there to look at your, help you look at your navel or to think about the world and to advance just general knowledge, but we're there to advance knowledge specifically for a real business opportunity. We also operate in a mode with shared risk. So you're taking the big risk to move forward this project. You need financial support, and we will partner with you in that respect. We'll bring to bear or bear some of that risk with our activity here in our involvement in the project. And the goal here is to create wealth in Canada and to have a return on this investment and to see jobs and economic benefits and so on. So it's very much focused on an economic aspect here. And another aspect to IRAP's mandate is this issue of technology leadership. Part of the reason we're involved here in this workshop today is to show leadership and to try to bring forward that aspect, kind of a mentoring aspect here, since that is the theme of Rising Star. So our summary of our programs, on the next slide here, Ron. Very, very briefly, we have two types of funding. Non-repayable funding, that's grant-type activity, on a cost-shared basis for the R&D cycle. And we do have a repayable program. It's a royalty-based financing. And as I said, it's small and medium-sized enterprises, and the idea here is to improve the core competence within the organization and leverage that into an opportunity. And the circumstances when you present a project to IRAP, it's got to have a return on investment, a rationalized business case, it's got to really make business sense. Next page, yeah. So the principal flagship program is just, first one, I have a list here which you can take a look at later on. Of the non-repayable programs, the grant-type programs. The first one is the Research Development Adaptation, or RDA, which we refer to. It's our flagship program. It maxes out at $500K shared. Typically, we might, not always the case, but we typically come in at 75% of the internal salary costs and 50% of subcontracts or consultants that are brought to bear here. So, again, next slide there. So, I guess that's basically just summarized what I just said here. The other point here is that, again, it's shared risk. So we're looking at, when you look at the total project cost, in the budget, the overheads, the equipment costs, etc., we only touch really, typically, we touch the internal labor and the subcontracts. But when you add in the other costs and so on, we're typically 50% of less or less than total project costs. And one very quick point on this, too, with IRAP support, I should mention that if you look at the whole of Atlantic Canada, given our budget for all of Atlantic Canada, if you look at our contributions on a project-by-project basis and the total activity in terms of costs associated with all these projects, we probably, on an average in here, represent our participation of DICS. The overall project activity probably represents a good $70-80 million of a private sector activity in Atlantic Canada, which is, you know, really significant in this region. So, again, the key elements in the research development adaptation is we want to see technical risk or technological uncertainty in the task areas in the project. There's an aspect of experimentation. It's non-routine activity. There are challenges. You don't know in a given task the path between A and B. So there's this uncertainty elements, and you have to have an iterative aspect to it. Systematic investigation, it's project-oriented, goal-oriented, and there's this notion also of a competitive technical intelligence aspect. You've got to have something that is really going to make sense business-wise. The repayable thing, it maxes out at $1 million. The one interesting point I'll mention on this is that on the balance sheet, it's repayable based upon royalty. So on the balance sheet, to venture capitalists, it looks like an equity investment. It's not equity, but it looks that way. So that's just a very interesting aspect to it. A couple final notes here. IRAP has been involved with some major names in the IT industry in Canada in their very early stages. Some of these are mentioned here. Research in Motion, it's like a $17 billion company that was originally a $20,000, $30,000 IRAP project way back when. It's a very big success story. There's others that are of that type. Even here locally, we have some significant stories here. And so finally, regarding OSS, open source is a new paradigm in industry. So IRAP seeks to improve or to help companies improve their capabilities. If the OSS, the project in mind that you have, has some sort of real commercial potential, we'll talk to you about it. Is there a real logical case for building your business around this? IP, intellectual property issues, have traditionally been proprietary in IRS scenarios, so this is new ground for us, but if there's a business case, we really should talk to us about it, and we can look at it. And certainly look at David Fellows' presentation later on. Intellectual property issue around the open source scenario is really something you have to pay attention to. So here's my contact information. Talk to us, give us a call, come and see me. I also have my business cards on the outside, on the tables outside if you want to pick one up. So that's it.
Thanks, William. Any questions for William before we get to the next speaker? That was a quick sit down. So our next speaker will be Peter Berg. Peter will give us a short introduction to OSS and why it is a business opportunity. He'll be highlighting local success stories in open source software development if his presentation hasn't changed in the last minute. So Peter has been involved with systems administration and systems integration since 1991, has been an avid user of Linux since 1994, and active with the Moncton Linux user group since 2000.
Okay.
You want me to do the, by the way, the...
Well, I think I can reach over here. All right. Afternoon, everybody. Before I get rolling, I'm just going to take a few minutes and log the Moncton Linux users group. You see our website up there. There's also a bunch of business cards outside if you're interested, you want to know more. Now, what's the point of having a Linux users group in town? We get together about every month. There's a technical talk. Somebody's doing something interesting or something they want to share with people. There's a bit of informal tech support. You know, I was trying to accomplish this and was having trouble, blah, blah, blah. So, we help each other out. There's also a mailing list. You don't have to come to meetings. You can just sign up for the mailing list. And if you want to know more about that, it's on the website there. The next meeting is going to be November 26th. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later on in the presentation.
Peter.
Yes.
Could you speak up a bit? I think it's a little hard in the back there.
Sure. And now I'm going to talk about some success stories here. And our website, if you're on that website, you'll see a link to those success stories written up. And I'm keep getting more feedback, so hopefully there will be more success stories on there soon. Now, what is open source software? Well, here's a fairly non-technical definition. When programmers on the internet can read, redistribute, and modify the source for a piece of software, it evolves. People improve it, people adapt it, people fix bugs. This rapid evolutionary process produces better software than the traditional closed model, in which only a very few programmers can see the source, and everyone else must blindly use an opaque block of bits. I say better. What do I mean? Open source software tends to be more flexible, tends to be very powerful, tends to be very reliable, and, of course, the price can't be beat. Now, here's the part I hate, the sales pitch. The reason I hate it is because I don't know enough about you folks to tell you what you should or shouldn't be using. I don't know what kind of problems you have to face. I don't know what kind of tasks you're trying to do. I don't know anything about your environment. So I don't know whether this open source software or that open source software make any sense for your environment. I can't stand up here and tell each and every one of you people that you should go into work tomorrow morning and start making plans to ditch all your legacy proprietary software and upgrade everything to Linux. I can't do that because I don't know enough. What I can tell you, the next time you've got something you want to do, you've got a problem you want solved, task you want to accomplish, you get to figure out how you're going to approach that. So you're evaluating different ways of doing it. While you're evaluating the normal proprietary ways that you would normally go about it, evaluate some of the open source solutions in that problem space, and I think you'll find that if you give this stuff a fair shake, it'll sell itself. No, that's great. Oh, that's bad. Yeah. The inherent flexibility, power, reliability, and low cost will usually sell this stuff without me having to. So I've got some success stories. We're going to talk about basically people who are in stuff with open source software right now while we're talking. You won't be surprised to see Linux being used in computer science programs, or I guess at UDM it's informatics. Because Linux comes, it's a full-featured development environment. You get free compilers, free development tools. And the nice thing, if I was setting up labs and courses and stuff, it's very easy for the students to run the exact same thing at home as they have at school. So that really simplifies stuff. You don't have to have students going out and paying for compilers and so on. And even way back in the Stone Age when I was in university, we were downloading Linux on floppy diskettes and taking it home and to help out with some of the higher level courses. So another place you're going to find Linux and open source creeping into universities is in the labs with OpenOffice and Mozilla. Now, I don't know how familiar you folks are with either of these projects. OpenOffice is a full-featured Office suite. It's very compatible with Microsoft Office. In fact, this is a PowerPoint slide, but it started out with OpenOffice. And I just exported it, emailed it to these folks, and I'm running it here with no problems at all. And it's cross-platform, so you don't have to commit to Linux. It runs on Windows, runs on macOS. So if you need a free Office suite with most of the features of the proprietary competitors, then you should have a look at it. Mozilla is a web browser. It's the current version of the Netscape code. It's as well as cross-platform. It has a lot of features. It's very secure, and it's been getting an awful lot of press lately, both in the trade press and in the normal conventional press. There was a nice article on the BBC about it the other day. So again, when I say Mozilla has a lot of features, just for an example, I've been running Mozilla for years, and I haven't seen a pop-up ad in 3 years. I've never had spyware. I don't even have a spyware checker on my machine because it's just not a problem. And if you're a web developer, then I'm sure you already know all about it because it's got some really nice tools for doing web development. Another really interesting thing in universities that I wasn't aware of until I started digging, there are an awful lot of Linux clusters, supercomputers, in the Maritimes. Dow has 4 or 5. Mount Allison has one in their chemistry department. In fact, this summer, the user group went down for a tour. Very interesting. St. FX has a physics cluster. UMB has one that's sort of shared by the civil engineering and computer science folks. UPI has a physics one. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Mount Allison one, because that's the only one that I've seen. Now, what they do there is computational chemistry. Now, the basic idea is some chemical reactions are so well understood that we can actually simulate what will happen if we combine certain components. Now, it takes a tremendous amount of computer horsepower, but we can actually simulate it. Now, you could always do it in the lab, but some of these compounds are expensive. Some of them are dangerous and require elaborate security precautions. And really, chemistry is still, in a lot of ways, there's a lot of trial and error that goes on. So we think this is going to work, so let's try it. But we have to try the computer first, and if it doesn't work, we don't have to waste lab time. So these folks, the interesting thing that I found is that these guys aren't interested in computers at all. All they really want is a tool to do their job. As far as they're concerned, if there was a box with hamsters running in wheels that could give them answers, then that's what they'd use. So they're not using this stuff because it's cool technology or has buzzwords. They're using this because it gets the answers that they want. And they just happen to use really cool technology to do it. Another example, in the charity and nonprofit space, the Moncton Boys and Girls Club have a problem. They have a bunch of computers used by both staff and the kids. The computers are donated. They depend largely on volunteers to do their computer support. And even at the best of times, keeping a student lab running and functional is pretty tough. Now, you can... one of the big problems they had was viruses and spyware and kids breaking the configuration and so on. How they address that is a Linux terminal server project. How many people here have ever used Windows terminal server? Anybody old enough to have used a Hardware X terminal back in the day? Okay. So you know what I'm talking about then. The idea is we've got a big centralized server out back somewhere, tightly locked down. All the client machines are booted off the network, so management is centralized. There's no configuration information on those workstations. So if anything goes wrong, we just reboot the thing and it is restored to its perfect, pristine, original config. Those terminals don't require much horsepower because they're not actually running anything. They're just drawing the pictures on their local display. And as a benefit, since we're doing this with Linux, and Mozilla, we've sidestepped all of the Internet Explorer vulnerabilities, all the viruses, all the worms that depend on either IE or Windows. So it's a win. Now, the next our next meeting, which will be November 26th, and that will be on the website as well, we're actually going to go and get a little demo here. We're going to visit the Boys and Girls Club and get a demo of this stuff. So if you're interested, as I say, check out the website, and we'll have more details as we firm up. But we just kind of set the date today, so we're still a little bit in flux. We'll talk a little bit about small business. Just one example, really. There's a company in Charlottetown, Engineering Technologies Canada. One of their products is a drag sled. Now, what that is, it's a sensor package that they use in accident reconstruction. So what you do is, apparently, you take this thing, you drag it down the highway, and it will tell you how slippery the road is, how much traction there is at different spots in the road. Now, what that device actually is, it's an embedded computer with a bunch of sensors. So they had some requirements. We've got to store all this data on a hard drive of some sort. We've got to get a way to download that data back onto someone's machine. We've got to be able to manage the thing. And there's a whole bunch of engineering stuff, you know, friction and all that stuff that I don't know anything about. So that's their department. Now, they decided to use Linux on that little embedded computer. And the reason they did that, it's very configurable. An embedded environment, it's awful nice to install only the very bare minimum of what you need and not bother installing all the rest of the junk. We don't have very much memory, we don't have very much hard drive space, so we got to keep the footprint down. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. What they decided to do is the management of this thing and downloading the data is done with a web interface. So there's a little web server running on that tiny little embedded computer. You plug it into the laptop, poof, pops the web page, you download a comma-separated file with all your data. And, you know, we just use proven solutions that are already work. So even a dumb fellow like me could take that embedded computer and set up Linux and a web server on there. It's not that hard. So what they could focus on is all the engineering stuff that, you know, that's where their expertise is. They're an engineering consulting company. So they understand the friction and the sensors and all that other stuff. So they spent most of their time worrying about the hard stuff, and they just plugged in all of this functional software to fill in the gaps to make a complete solution. Individuals. Now, I kind of hate to do it, but I'm going to have to put somebody on the spot here. A gentleman by the name of Steve Mallett, he's here today actually. He is the open source directory founder and managing editor. Now, the reason that I'm talking about Steve is he started out with a few ideas, a couple of desktop machines and a Red Hat CD. And today, his website gets 2 million hits a day, and he's well-known in the open-source community. In fact, he's so popular that he had to stop hosting it in his basement and had to actually go to a colo and, you know, redundant power, redundant network paths, and all that stuff. Because 2 million hits a day, apparently you can't run that out of your basement. I wouldn't know. Now, when I say he's well-known, he's the webmaster for the open-source initiative. He gets to attend all kinds of high-profile conferences and events. And now, here's the big thing. Now that Steve has new ideas, because he seems to have a lot of ideas, people are listening. Now, I've got a point here, and it's not simply to embarrass Steve. What I'm trying to get at here is the barriers to entry are falling, and open source is a big part of that. Here's a gentleman who's gone from zero to computer industry personality, and he hasn't spent a nickel on software. Now, think about that. And I guess that's my basic point. That's my conclusion. If I was doing this presentation to a Fortune 500 company that had a lot of money, then I wouldn't be stressing the low-cost thing. Because in a lot of people's minds, there's a big tie between the amount of money that I spend for something and how good it is. But I don't think in the Maritimes we can afford to have those ideas. I think there's a lot more brain power here. I think there are a lot more ideas here than there is money. So if there are people out here who happen to have brain power, who happen to have ideas, and they don't happen to have any money, if you've got something you want done, then I think you owe it to yourself to look at an open source way of getting it done. That's it. If there's any questions, there's business cards with the address for our website. As we firm up more details about our next meeting, then that'll make it to the website. And feel free to sign up for the mailing list. We're a friendly bunch. Questions?
Yep.
Or do I have time?
Is the development of the open source use There's a number of different areas that are looking at productivity tools as well as operating systems and stuff. Do you see that evolving in any one direction? Is it going to become more like an appliance sort of technology development?
The thing about open source is that there is no one direction, because once you throw something out there, then people start using it in ways that they never intended. So it tends to get stretched and pulled and in all sorts of strange directions. The only way something goes in one particular direction is if somebody with either deep pockets or a few dedicated developers goes and, you know, drives it in that direction. So, I don't know.
Like IBM, for instance?
Like IBM, for example, yeah.
There's been
or Sun or something. I mean, Sun has spent a pile of money on just some fine-tuning and just the consistency across several packages so that they all kind of look the same. So, you know, they happen to have a human interaction team. So they set those guys on the problem, and they went, and there we go. We've driven it in a particular direction. So that's the only way you can influence things.
So basically, it's operating as being, because it's kind of like an acid test that's pumping, right?
Sure, yeah, that's the...
Is there any concerns about, like, quality control, or trojans being built into
yep.
it?
Yes.
Is there anything being done about that?
We depend on the package. So, I mean, if you... the problem with saying open source is that it covers a huge spectrum. So, if you're downloading something from a random website, that's different than if you're buying in a package from Red Hat or if IBM consultants are coming in and setting it up for you. So, like, if IBM comes in and sets it up for you, then they're kind of on the hook and responsible for whatever happens. If you're poor and you're downloading stuff off the website, then you have to take a bit more of that responsibility for yourself. But I'll just make a point. The problems you raise are also there with stuff you buy off the shelf, right? That's not unique to open source. So.
I noticed on some of the sites where you can download from, they actually have visual certificates where you can authenticate the version that you're getting, so there's some sort of goal in place.
Yep.
Is that something you advocate as well?
Sure. I think most projects are doing that because there were a couple of scares in the last couple of years, so pretty much everybody has an MD5 sum these days. So, you know, this is the official release, and nobody's kind of come in and tampered.
How popular is open source compared to other technologies?
It depends. I mean, the open source web server has Apache, the open source web server, has more market share than everything else put together. Linux is becoming tremendously possible on the server side, not so much on the desktop. Open source email technology routes probably 2/3 to 3/4 of the email in the world today. So in certain niches, it's tremendously popular. Every time you open your web browser and try to resolve monktonlug.sf.net, that has to get resolved to an IP address. And the software that does that is open source and has been for 25 years. So in niches, it's dominant. In other niches, it's still growing. It's such a vague term because it covers so much. Like, there are probably millions of packages that are available with an open source license. So trying to say anything general about all of them is pretty hard. I don't know.
And I think what he's trying to say is he's trying to compare how the teams work with the traditional proprietary software that you go out as you work and you hire and you know all the people who are working on it. With open source software, anybody from the world, it's all done pretty much over the internet. So it's very distributed.
I'm wondering how many companies are established themselves.
I guess I didn't understand the question.
Sure. We're actually on the product. Go ahead. By concentration.
I'm not sure, because my bias is I'm from the system administration side, not the development side. So my idea of open source is, okay, great, I can download this stuff and solve problems. As far as developing stuff and a business model, like, I use it as a crutch to get me where I want to go. I don't develop with it, so I guess I haven't really thought about those issues, to be honest. Sorry.
Where does the dollar change hands in this whole scenario?
It depends. Like, some stuff is... depends on the package. I mean, some people are hired by IBM full-time. They've got, you know, probably a few hundred people by now who write stuff that eventually gets released under an open source license. Some stuff is done strictly by volunteers. Some stuff is done by... There's a lot of stuff coming out of universities. Like, if you want to talk about environment, people have a lot more brain power than they have cash. You know, there are some problems that are consistently seen in the IT space. So the IT staff at universities tends to tackle those. It gets released under an open source license. Other people start picking it up. Like the Apache web server grew mostly out of universities because they all wanted to serve web pages. They all had the same problems. They all had dedicated smart people on staff, but no cash. So they started work that eventually became the Apache web server.
That tells me that everybody involved in that already had a paycheck.
That's right. In that project.
I'm an entrepreneur and I want to generate a paycheck for myself. Where do I get it out of this model?
I think some of the other speakers might have more to say, because as I say, my bias, that's not my bias. I use stuff that already exists.
The short answer to that question is you use the open source to leverage what you already have. That's the short answer.
Okay.
Just sum it up here. But you might want to introduce, I saw it, notice that Ian just came in, if anyone's got any questions about EdTech.
The newsletter is a heretic of open thing. So he'll discover, right, that is Andy, open by language, slide, and how it used in e-business. Stephen's a researcher with base here in Moncton. His principal work in research and development in Maine, working with solutions and companies to their competitive as the industry, and outreach articles, seminars, and shops. As a matter of fact, has just is checked from a month trip Australia, giving a 17th presentation in 30 days. No cost to the Canadian player, I might add. A lot of cost to Australian player. Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks. Whether this is too tall, too short, not quite the title of my talk, it's a tent. Sometimes what people do, students. Somebody asks a tent or a content on a cell. Then, unless you are a large company, Disney or Microsoft, you want to make sure that the distribution environment for learning materials is source. Because the alternative, as a provider, is that to a large degree, you will be frozen of this marketplace. Because open source, it's not about price, it's about the access. It's about knowing how being able to get content into the system. You knowing how being able to interact with the network. Digital rights management and open digital rights management is a very good study of that. It's not the only thing, it's a part of the work I do. I'll briefly introduce the digital rights. Very briefly, I'll talk. Is that good thing I'm learning how to use this operation? People talk about DRM, and they have an idea of DRM as being a thing that locks on content. But DRM is actually a combination of different approaches and technologies. Specifically, we have about three major areas of digital rights management. Area is the expression. That is to say, who owns thing and who has permission to use it. Another area of digital management is citation. That's where you show you are the person who has the right to use something. And then finally, the third area of digital management is the people are most familiar with, and that's enforcement. Locking down content, example, by encrypting a single entity. It can be applied for resource specific. It can also be just being applied at this point. For an example, you get into the network call unless you have a bank with a PIN number. It gives us a DRM design. And when people talk DRM, they often think about network with full protection of that. But in fact, in digital rights, there's a wide range of alternatives. Examples of all of them. For example, a simple expression of your rights is resource-based. Could be something as simple as the great notice in the front book.
Okay, well, is that a fact?
Well, of course it is.
The protection that books are not locked down. The cop notice is generally sufficient to the content of the book.
On your hand, you have things that are much more, such as the PMCM system, separate to documents. So no, that's not.
Digital rights.
National network, having objects, distribute them to schools and universities across the country. Our group at NRC responsible for the digits management. The approach that took was an express approach. That is, this, we were most interested in digital expression opposed to digital enforcement. And I'll talk about the reasons for that moment. If we wanted to build at a direct level, that is, we wanted expression, digital rights be available throughout the network and be simply resource-based and not simply access-based. So the approach I had was as wide scope as possible, but the minimum has been possible. That said, if we took, had to be careful not include grid enforcement if there were vendors with. So a vendor could create encrypted or if you source a lot of the college university and different languages, which is a proprietary. They claim royalty on it, and they're hard through the search process. They fit so that it became, instead of XML, it became PEG, RE, so they got it through everything. And then they pushed it ISO, so now ISO, RE, and they're pushing through as well, or trying to through other standards. So we looked at that, well, do we want all the colleges and universities to be paying to royalties to Microsoft in order to protect their digital content? We thought that was a bad idea. The other approach looked at is a language called digital rights language, ODRL. ODRL is similar to XML, except that it is not royalties attached. Open digital rights language. Excuse me. They may be for example, a mission, a copy, provide KS money. And ODRL in particular has two acts to its rights definition. One hand, you find what is called an offer. So you have something mail, you can in old ERS what you will sell it for or the condition which somebody uses it. And on the other, you may create an agreement. That is to say, contract reaching to people knowing the use of a digital resource under such conditions. And obviously, language of offers may be very similar to language of. Right. I wish it was from this building written that.
Later on.
ODRL get and digital rights language get quite in a hurry. There are various permissions to say, print, play, execute, express. Color, time, people, mostly familiar with. For that matter, so is RML, nothing an XML you can use to its rights. And that's what Concord wants to charge policies for. Now, why did we switch? Well, in source, and we're trying to create a national content network. And so, before making selection of the rights languages with criteria, thought would be important in the Canadian HTML sector. Open standards. The mechanism for expressing and authenticating, and even pretend, ought to be accessible and used by anyone. Because if you are not able to access it in order to use it, you cannot claim this game at all. You can't provide materials to the system, not consume it from the system. The bottlenecks tend to prevent. The idea is that you have even one component of your network. You have only one provider. The entire network revolves around that component. And if one component raises price or is usage restrict conditions, the whole network has to play. And we hope that in order to test the interest of both vendors of materials and consumers of learning materials, that any component network has to be provided by any entity in the network. Finally, what we are after is an open market so that the agency buy resources on network or any agency may sell resources on the network. This is a model from the content model being used for a lot of content. Typically, when you ask a content provider, when you act, that would allow not in place, putting content into the system, but incurring a lot of overhead. So, the way to do that was to make the network, to make the standard network open, the mechanics of the network open. That you can be an author of content out of it. You don't have to be a large with them with paper software, paper royalties. What we did
in edges in the model of life. We also messed around a bit with the digital rights. Take people think of the right associated with an object, traveling with the object, the copyright in the book, the publisher information, the CD. That's what's been taught a lot in the learning reason industry. And what we is we set a file, maybe a JPEG, you know, it's metadata, and the pointer point to its own. Why did we do it? It seems sort of dumb. Well, again, a big problem for some agents is tend the rights for these laws, making sure the rights are properly expressed. They're producing a lot of risks, then make sure that these rights express a fair amount of overhead. So we set up a system whereby single rights can apply to a large number of learning resources. So what you do with a small agency, you define one, two, three, a few rights files, we call them models, and in your first metadata, you put the rights model on to apply. Now, we didn't invent this. I don't know who invented it. A very common version of this of approach is Creative Commons. It's on the internet. It may be freely used by is you on your web in the form of a URL, the Creative License. Creative Commons is very much in that model. One Creative Commons license can be used by hundreds, thousands, millions of sources. You all point to license because you own the same thing. We say Commons attribution non-commercial like model. So here's how it's in a little bit more depth. The object metadata, XML, is the learning resource. Embedded in the data is a port to the location of the ODR. Now, that was the basic part. And then what we did is we took the elements of what would constitute a tech network, and we did it. Basically, we took the sorts of things that are soft and put all in a package of access here. Vendors, if you're a small agent, a small company, the metadata is the broker, the current conditions use of this resource. And the searcher wish access the resource or conditions, for example, pay money. When this is satisfied, they are providing the key gives them access to us. The idea here is that we wanted to create an intermediary that would handle any of the digital functions so that not the producer of resources, the consumer of resources would be required to set all of that. And the main reason for this is because we need it to be possible to certain or bypass the digital part of the distribution model you didn't want. Now, that what thing there is, it's an encryption process. Just simply register for access to resources such as PayPal on the website as well. But as you can, there are projects happening here. Now, how do you make off of open software? Well, the few thing, this network set up on free software. That means that there's a lot of traffic on this network because people can access the network and use the network without any overhead. It's like the web. It can cost you money to see for the web. It was just there. You don't have to pay an entity to use our web browser. So, there's a lot of traffic happening here, including commercial traffic. By accessing the network, by tapping into the commercial traffic, we're able to provide services that are part of this network and create revenue flow. For example, you can act as a provider or a financial tax where you're registered here, right here, registered right off the top. Like a road system where anybody can access the road, and where everybody, where the road goes, everybody knows how to build a way, everybody knows how to car, and then opportunities that are generated by the traffic road. But you get, by trying to charge people for driving on the road, where you get money is in services for people who are already in the road for free.
You
give
them the road when they
go. Well, you can imagine, based on what I've had, what I want about toll booths. But I'm not going to go into that. So here's an example. You're a provider of a resource. You're a consumer of a resource. You choose the broker, selling everything for you. You can just tell the broker what vendor of learning resources. And if you want, either choose the express to go down, or generate your optimized declaration of rights, expression of rights in a row. Just to very briefly point to where things are going. This model, this distributed model, anybody can buy it or anybody can be a reader is being not only digital rights, but it is all being applied to other areas of commerce. One of the things I've talked about a lot when we were setting up the model at NRC was we need also an identification server, some distributed means of having people create and name a personal identity. This has been developed, or is literally in development, by a company in British Columbia, XIP, and NRC. You have mentioned this is an example of an open hobby, and we'll handle questions so briefly.
What I think of is the cell, even sending the data.
Right.
So you can not just software, you're not just sending it with the software to zero because of the perfect competition. You're sending the data down to zero because of perfect competition.
Right.
And the only thing that's going to be left in the cell is going to be
services.
Well, I used to be teaching was a service.
Well, think of
it. But you're transforming a service to data, and you're making it so that, and you're looping so that the data, the value goes out.
Well, this is not I'm doing, the value is going to zero anyways, okay? You have to do it. Services are to be what value in the future, right?
Right.
Things can be reproduced for little cost. That for content. Content can be reproduced for technical. So, A, duplicated, and B, and that's the market event. You guys know this, or you do, right? You're not set up business plan, business model based on declining risk. You shouldn't. Anyone would recommend it. That would be good business advice.
Having a system where you might be able to define some data as certainly better than other data. So that, say, the article from Britannica, because it's been vetted by people and hasn't been helped, is worth $1 to you today, but if you're not worth $1, you can have this Wikipedia that may or not have, well, that may or may not be the best data that's verified.
You know what? But because being the best and being the best isn't to give you a price advantage anymore, because second best is pretty darn good. You can't duplicate easily. Someone's got to look at the hell share, the market.
Yourself a certain company and get money. And I think when you get your money, you get in on that market, put yourself out there. Less than the cost of market, but I don't know this whole plumbing up kind of stuff. That's, you can get yourself in a whole great basket.
Well, I'm not sure. People are already seeing ratings and evaluations being put out there on the now. So it's a market people are in. Whether or not it's a good market, it's a market people are in. Whether or not you trust things, still something that's happening. There will be there's of the raiders. And then elephants on.
Do you make provisions to not allow something to happen on this marketplace? Stopping 10, 12, 15 all being aligned together, coming up and coming down on things?
Nope. I think the thing about work is that, I mean, it's the old dictum. Make sure people do or do such and such. What you can. So, if you use that points to alter,
I'm sure he can pick up on them. I think, well, go to the coffee break given the time.
Well,
it's short then, most likely. Yes. But if anybody can do that, everybody can be back maximum 10 minutes starting at 7.
The point is, you have the presenter for the Fox session sitting in the I have to wait.
Not everyone. I think they don't understand. I'm not too sure.
Yeah, about so. No, but we can coffee outside. Ultra is having all taken. And they're all both presenting.